The structure at 515 Federal Street was built about 1820 and is a good example of that period's vernacular style. Feel free to go inside and visit when the studio is open. Then follow Church Street until it meets Chestnut and turn right. You'll arrive at the Rising Sun Lodge No. 4, 516 Chestnut Street. Rising Sun Lodge, the structure you're facing now, was built as a Presbyterian church in 1834 and served as a school in the late 1800s. In the early 1900s, it was an African-American Methodist church. It was purchased by Rising Sun Lodge No. 4 in the 1930s. The lodge is affiliated with the Prince Hall Masonic Order, founded in 1775 to serve men of color. A small graveyard behind the building dates from the early 1800s. Jack Clark, the lodge historian, tells us more about the lodge and its founding.
So Prince Hall Masons were strictly a black organization, chartered from England for the black people. In fact, he was one of the Revolutionary War heroes or fighters, you know. And he petitioned to start this lodge, Prince Hall Lodge, and that's why it's called Prince Hall Masons. We've got the original charter and everything. We've got the original charter for this lodge, too, from 1853. Back in the 1840s, the men of color were going to Wilmington. Were working out of Wilmington. There were no jobs around here, and the people that could travel went to Wilmington to work. And there they started to learn about Masons, because the Pennsylvania Masons had a lodge set up in Wilmington so that the brothers could learn about the lodge, about Masons. Mm-hmm. So what happened is Grandmaster at that time, the Pennsylvania Grandmaster, chartered the first lodge in Delaware, which was in Wilmington. That was called Star of the East Lodge. And in 1852, the men in the lower Delaware who were working in the Wilmington area at that time, they became interested in masonry. So they petitioned to have a lodge set up in Milton. And then they lucked out. And then within a year, they had a lodge set up in Milton. And the first lodge hall was a personal home. And from there, it grew and grew. It took off, I'd say within 10 years span.
Directly across the street from Rising Sun at numbers 515 and 517 Chestnut Street, you'll see two identical Victorian Gothic style houses. Cross the street so you can take a closer look. The homes you're now viewing were owned by the McGee brothers, ship captains who built the houses side by side in about 1875. Note the scrollwork ship wheels in the upper cross gable. The Victorian trim built on many homes constructed during this period may be the work of ship carpenters who spent their off periods building houses. We don't really know how large a factor ship carpenters were in the development of the town's architecture, but we do know that Milton has a wider variety of late 19th century housing than any other town of similar size in Lower Delaware. Right behind the McGee properties, you'll see Dogfish Head Craft Brewery. Tours of the brewery are available. Call for dates and times. As you look at the modern brewery, it might be hard to imagine the old Draper King Cole cannery that used to be housed here. The cannery was built in 1902 and purchased in 1907 by Harry R. Draper, who canned peas and tomatoes. In the late 20th century, Draper King Cole was the largest family-owned vegetable processor east of the Mississippi River. The cannery closed in 1999. Joe Black grew up near here, on Chestnut Street, and worked in the cannery as a teenager. He remembers what it was like.
But when I worked there, a lot of it was done by hand. You know, they didn't have the machinery then that they have now, or had even 20 years ago. I did everything from working in the fields, in the bean fields with a hoe, right out here not too far from where we live. I think the pay was 25 cents an hour then. I remember putting in 100 hours one week when I was like 15 or 16, and made $25. I thought, all the money in the world. It was mostly just summertime work then, you know. I started in the pea season and worked through the lima bean season, and that was most of the summer. A lot of local help, most all of local help. Now, I think I probably knew almost everybody that worked there, practically. And there were a lot of people, a lot of women worked there too, you know, because like I said before, beans were put on like a belt. And they would sit there and pick out all the bad beans and throw them away. sorted them out before they were canned. Then they had machines that did the crimping work, like Betty was saying, that they used to do by hand on the farm. Well, they had big machines that that crimped the can tops then, and they'd go through a line, you know, snake through there, and I don't know how many they would do a minute, but probably 100 cans a minute.
As we head back toward the center of town on Chestnut Street, imagine a busy railroad station, which moved the cannery's goods to market. As Joe relates, the presence of the railroad made this area a lively part of town.
I don't know whether that was before the Queen Anne or whether it was during the Queen Anne line, but they used to bring horses in from the west, and there was a dealer, Sam Wilson. They had a hardware store and a farm store, and it was located right down where the Wilmington Trust Bank is now. And I remember when I was a kid, when they brought these horses in on a train and unloaded them, they would herd them down Chestnut Street when it was still dirt, and I guess they would tame those horses some way, I guess like cowboys do, they'd break them for farm work. I remember it didn't occur too many times while I was growing up, but I'm sure it did quite a bit before I would know what it was, you know, maybe before I was born. But I remember seeing maybe one or two bunch of horses going by the house, you know, and they were taking them down to Sam Wilson's store there. Eventually sell to the farmers.
By the early part of the 20th century, agriculture was a critical component of Milton's economic well-being. But farming was difficult, and labor problems were hard to solve. Gladys Wilkins was born on the farm where she still lives. She recalls that Milton's farmers have always faced tough challenges.
Had to almost go out of the farming business because there was no help when to work on the farms. When I was in school, I was telling someone just recently, in May, we would go to school Saturday mornings until 1 o'clock on Saturday, and that was counted as a complete day. But we would get out in early May so that the boys could work on farms, and then they did not have to go to school until the ending of September. Because get the harvest done the fall, and they were not counted absent or anything for that time. And it was hard, you know, it was very hard.
With the onset of World War II, labor problems became even more challenging. Draper King Cole now relied heavily on migrant labor for its operation, first Bahamians, then Southern blacks, and later Puerto Ricans. The migrants who worked in the cannery added to the lively atmosphere on Chestnut Street, especially on Saturday afternoons when, dressed in their finery, they would parade down Chestnut Street to hang out at the Blue Goose, a restaurant and bar on Front Street, right across from the river. Following in their footsteps, let's continue east on Chestnut, pausing for just a moment when we reach Poplar Street. Poplar Street, our current stop, is a typical Milton lane. Here we can see a privy, a shed, and a poultry house. Don Fisher grew up close by on Federal Street. He tells colorful stories about when the chicken business came to town.
By the time the war came, University of Delaware had the extension thing over there on the Laurel Road, and they started dabbling in broilers, chicken. And the war got underway, and rationing came into play. Meat was rationed, chicken was not. So, people, the chicken factory everywhere. Every town had chicken, and chicken houses all over. So, I mean, they like built chicken houses. There's a chicken house down the alley. Yeah, chicken house. And so, chickens, what made the chickens go during the war, as I said, it was because it was an unrationed meat supply. And the market was New York and Philly. The chicken plants, you know, anybody who had a few bucks, I mean, you know, some lawyers in Georgetown or something like that, put some money together, have a chicken plant, and build a chicken plant. In those days, all they did was kill the chicken and take the feathers off and put them in a box, ship the whole chicken, no evisceration then. And then they throw them in these, throw a scoop of ice in the box, throw the chickens in there, throw another scoop of ice on top, close it up, and they didn't care if they were purple, green, or what. I mean, it was a chicken, and it was going to New York City.
The next yard, at the corner of Chestnut Street and Manship Lane, is 418 Chestnut, the brick home of Handy Prettyman. Handy Prettyman's father acquired this home at 418 Chestnut Street as well as other Chestnut Street properties, in the mid to late 19th century. He was one of many free people of color living in town at the time. Most worked as farmers, laborers, blacksmiths, bricklayers, ship carpenters, and sailors. They lived alongside whites, with the town divided more by socioeconomic class and occupation rather than race. As mentioned earlier, Handy, and later his son James, were quite prominent. They owned and operated their own ice businesses, serving the town from 1897 until 1968. Jack Clark shares his memories of the ice business.
Mr. Handy had a ice house, and he used to bring ice from Georgetown or somewhere, and it stored over there, and he'd sit out there and sell ice right off of that. Even before that, I guess about the same time, had an ice house, an ice trailer right beside the lodge hall. Mr. Handy and Mr. James Furman, they used to had ice crushers and everything. They would crush ice for Reed's Trucking Company. And you could see Reed's trucks backed in here, and the Furmans would be icing them down and everything. So that was something to remember while we're on the ice thing, well, at home we had ice boxes. We never had refrigerators. And Mr. Handy and James both would go around town. And Mr. Handy used to do it in a horse and buggy. And, of course, when the sun came up, James, he had a truck. But they would come around, and every time the ice man come, they'd chip off a piece of ice for all the kids in the neighborhood, give everybody a piece of ice, you know. I can remember those days.
Yeah, that was a treat.
Yeah, it was a treat. It's like a snow cone or something, you know. It was fun. Yeah.
Continuing east on Chestnut Street, originally named Apple Tree Street, we see a typical mix of Milton's architecture, a cast sand house, bungalows from the early 1900s, 19th century Gothic Revival style homes, and mid-19th century vernacular houses, some modified with later Victorian elements. The town of Milton is now involved in a multi-phased project to expand the current Milton Historic District. As many as 180 structures could be added to the 198 structures that were placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1982. Structures under consideration include workers' houses, African American and Native American resources, early 20th century industrial and commercial sites, and numerous other buildings dating between the early 19th and the early 20th century, like the bungalow we're standing in front of now. The upper and lower sections of Chestnut Street are central to this effort. If you look across the street, you'll see the Golden Rule Lodge No. 17 at 315 Chestnut Street. The lodge was established in 1848 by the International Order of Odd Fellows. Like Rising Sun Lodge and Endeavor Lodge, Golden Rule Lodge was a fraternal organization significant to the building and sustaining of small-town civic life. It has housed school classes and the town's library. Now let's go south on Atlantic Street. We'll walk one short block, then turn left on Walnut Street, pausing at the Tingle House, number 313. We believe that the Tingle House, where we're standing now, was built on or before 1915 for the African-American Mary E. Tingle. The property on which the existing house stands was owned earlier by Daniel and Lizzie Oney, a free African-American sailor and his wife. The Oneys lived here as early as 1862. African-American ship carpenter James White and his wife Mariah lived next door. Let's continue on, pausing at 301 Walnut, the Lank Shivelhood House. The original house at 301 Walnut was built around 1800. It has an addition dating to about 1830. John H. Lank was a sea captain of a famed Milton seafaring family. Elizabeth Lank Shivelhood was his descendant and a local educator. As we leave the Lank Shivelhood house, we will turn right onto Coulter. But first, stop and take a look at the Goshen Methodist Cemetery. Visitors are invited to walk in the cemetery and look at the graves which date from the early 1800s. The block is also the first site of the Goshen Methodist Church, established in 1801, and of the Milton Academy, established in 1819. Milton Academy was located on the Coulter Street end. It was later the site of the Milton Public School. The church was built in the middle of the block and was surrounded by the graveyard. Goshen Church relocated to Federal Street in the 1870s and moved again to its current Federal Street location in the 1960s. As we start up again, return to the site of the Lank Scheibelhund House at number 301 Walnut Street and proceed down Coulter Street. When we come to the corner of Coulter and Collins, we'll stop for a moment. We're at the corner of Coulter and Collins now, looking at a cluster of 19th and early 20th century houses long owned by the related Clark and Drain families of Nanticoke, European, and African American heritage. As just mentioned, Milton had a strong community of free people of color, including both African Americans and Native Americans. The Clarks and Drains were founding members of Bethel AME Church and Rising Sun Lodge No. 4 in the first half of the 19th century, and the First Congregational Church in the early 20th century. The Clark family made their living from farming, and Jack Clark has fond memories of his father's work, especially the hog killings.
Oh, yeah, my uncle, right across from my grandpa, he used to kill hogs every year. He would raise four or five hogs, three or four hogs, whatever. But at that time, different farmers would. This farm would have a hog killing this week, the next one had one the next week, the next one had, and they'd go from farm to farm to farm and help each other to kill hogs. That was a big day. They would go in and kill the hogs. I had somebody going in before light, real early of the morning, get the fires built. They had big kettles, you know. Get the kettles all hot. Dad was one of the guys that would do the shooting. That would kill them over. And then they have to bleed them out. So they would cut their throat and bleed them out. And then they would drag them over and scald them, scrape the hair. They had particular scrapers to scrape the hair off. The hide would be really clean. You know, they would wipe it down with lye soap and all that, you know. Then it would hang them on what they call a swingle tree from a tripod. And that's where they would start working on him. And cut him up and all that. And then after the whole killing was all finished, the ladies would have a big dinner for them, for all the guys. They'd have chicken and dumplings and fresh pig meat and stuff like that, you know. And that was a big celebration. And that happened almost every hog killing. And then, of course, it was putting meat away for the winter. That was their staple for the winter, you know, their meat staples. So but that was a big thing, but they're very rare. You very seldom hear them now. They do have them, but not like they used to. I would say probably maybe 10% of it. But it was mostly for family. Mm-hmm. So nowadays, I do know guys that go out to community hog killings, and they might kill 6 or 8 or 10 hogs. Like 3 or 4 families come together now and do it. Then they, a lot of times they go ahead and make their sausage, grapple, and other cuts of meat, and they would package it for sale. But that's not like it used to be. I was a little guy. I used to like help to build the fires and stuff like that, you know. Just being around them was, and it's been years since I've been to one.
So your dad enjoyed that?
Oh, yeah. Yes, he did. Yeah. And I think a lot of times the older guys, got together and it was an event for them just to get together and shoot the hash. And
so it was social as well as
getting the job done.
A great meal.
Yeah, it was.
As we turn left and head back towards the center of town, we're on Mill Street, one of Milton's earliest streets. The high end of Mill Street is in an area of town known as Puddin' Hill. Mill Street parallels the river, and its location made it safe from floods and mosquitoes. Of particular note are numbers 313 and 317, since parts of both date from the 1700s. When we reach Chestnut again, we will want to take a look at number 115. In 1812, this was the only house on the entire block. Its lot was bordered by Chestnut Street, Mill Street, Walnut Street, and Front Streets. The shed behind the house was once a button shop. Next door, at the corner of Chestnut and Mill, stands Endeavor Masonic Lodge No. 17, established in 1851. We'll continue on Mill until we reach Federal Street. Here you might want to explore the architecture a bit more, or you might want to take a break at the Federal Street Espresso Bar.